So, cryptography, it's one of those things, right? You hear it everywhere, but how many people actually understand what it is or how it works? We're diving deep into it today.
Yeah, it's kind of the silent guardian of the digital world in a lot of ways.
Protecting us from all sorts of digital mischief, but really what we're talking about is secret writing, and it's ancient.
Oh, absolutely. It goes way
I
back.
mean, the Egyptians were using hieroglyphs to hide messages. Like, talk about old school encryption. And it's fascinating to think how it's evolved, from those early methods to the sophisticated algorithms used today.
Right. And what's really interesting is that whether you're talking about ancient hieroglyphs or the latest quantum cryptography, the goals are essentially the same. It all boils down to those four key principles: confidentiality, integrity, authentication, and non-repudiation. Those are like the pillars of cryptography.
Okay, so those four pillars, let's break them down. Confidentiality, that seems pretty straightforward. You want to keep your secrets secret.
Exactly. It's all about making sure that information is only accessed by those authorized to see it, like a digital vault for your data.
Okay, so that's like the digital lock. Now, what about integrity? That sounds important.
Integrity is about making sure that the information hasn't been tampered with. So when you send something, it arrives exactly as you sent it. Think of, let's say, a legal document sent electronically. Integrity ensures that it can't be changed without anyone knowing.
Oh, okay. So it's like a digital seal of authenticity then.
Exactly.
So how do we know who actually sent the message, with everything being digital? That's where authentication comes in.
You got it. Authentication verifies the sender's identity. So if you get an email that says it's from your bank, authentication helps prove it's really from them and not some scammer.
Okay, that is absolutely critical these days with so many phishing attempts. So we've got confidentiality, integrity, authentication. What about non-repudiation?
That one's about accountability. So think of it this way. Non-repudiation means someone can't deny sending a message or participating in a transaction. They can't say, "Nope, wasn't me." It's like a digital paper trail.
Like a digital signature. You can't really argue with that. So to sum it up, we have these four pillars: confidentiality, integrity, authentication, and non-repudiation. They form the foundation of any cryptographic system. But how do we actually achieve this? What are those building blocks, those secret codes?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. That's where we get into the nuts and bolts of cryptography. The techniques and tools used to make information incomprehensible to anyone without the proper authorization.
So let's get technical. What exactly are we trying to protect?
At the most basic level, we're talking about information. In cryptography, we call this plain text, basically, your message in its original readable form.
So, like our conversation right now, that would be plain text.
Exactly. But let's say we want to keep this conversation private. That's where encryption comes in. Encryption takes that plain text, our conversation, and transforms it into something unreadable, something we call ciphertext. It's like translating our words into a secret language.
A secret language that only someone with the right decoder ring can understand.
Right. And that decoder ring, in the world of cryptography, is the key.
The key, oh, okay, like a password almost.
Yeah, kind of. The key unlocks the encrypted message, deciphers it. Without the right key, you're stuck with gibberish.
And I'm guessing losing your key is a very bad day.
You could say that. Managing those keys, keeping them secure, that's a huge part of cryptography. But the keys aren't the whole story. We also have these things called encryption algorithms. Think of them like mathematical recipes that dictate how the information gets scrambled and unscrambled.
So the key is like the password to open the safe, and the algorithm is the design of the safe itself.
That's a great way to think about it. And just like we have different safes for different purposes, we have different algorithms designed for different situations.
It's all about choosing the right tool for the job. You also mentioned hashing earlier. Where does that fit into all of this?
Ah, yes, hashing. Now, hashing is a bit different. Unlike encryption, which is a two-way process, hashing is a one-way street. You take your message, no matter how long, and create a unique fingerprint of it, called a hash value.
A fingerprint, so it's like you're turning an entire book into a single unique code.
Exactly. And here's the really cool part. Even the tiniest change to the original message, like changing a single comma, will completely change the hash value.
Oh, that's really clever. So you can instantly tell if something's been tampered with. But if you can't reverse it, what's the point of creating this unique code, this hash?
Well, that's the beauty of it. Let's say you send a message, and you also send the hash value of that message. The recipient can then generate their own hash of the message and compare it to yours. If they match, they know the message hasn't been altered in transit.
It's like a tamper-proof seal. So we have encryption for confidentiality, hashing to guarantee integrity, and keys acting as the gatekeepers. Seems like a pretty solid system, right?
It's a good start. But the world of cryptography never sits still. There's always someone trying to find a way to break the code, which is why cryptographers are constantly developing new and even stronger methods to protect information.
So it's an ongoing arms race.
You could say that. And that brings us to the different types of encryption techniques. Ready to dive a little deeper?
Okay, lead the way. I'm ready to go deeper.
All right, so we talk about cryptography, and it seems like this super complicated thing, right? But really, when you boil it down, there are these two basic approaches, substitution and transposition.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. Like from cracking codes as a kid. Substitution, that's where you swap one letter for another, right?
Exactly. A classic example is the Caesar cipher. Julius Caesar, the Roman emperor, he used it. Basically, you shift each letter down the alphabet a certain number of places. Super simple, but you can see the concept of substitution right there.
Wow, and that was enough to protect military secrets back then.
Well, it worked for a while. But you're right, simple substitution ciphers, they're pretty easy to break. Just looking at how often certain letters appear can give you clues. But the Caesar cipher, it paved the way for more complicated substitution ciphers, things like monoalphabetic and polyalphabetic ciphers.
Those sound way more complex. What's the difference?
Okay, so think of a monoalphabetic cipher, like using one scrambled alphabet for your message. Every time you see an A, you replace it with, say, a Q, and so on. Consistent substitution throughout.
Like a really advanced decoder ring?
Exactly. But even if that alphabet is randomized, it's still vulnerable to frequency analysis. That's where polyalphabetic ciphers come in. They use multiple alphabets. So you might switch between different substitution schemes throughout the message. Like the Vigenère cipher, it uses a keyword to determine which alphabet to use and when.
So like having multiple decoder rings and you keep switching them up. That's clever.
Yeah, it makes it way harder to crack because the letter frequencies get all messed up. But, you know, there's always a trade-off, right? The more complex the cipher, the harder it is to use.
I can imagine. So that's substitution. What about this other one, transposition?
Right, transposition. Instead of replacing letters, you just rearrange them.
Yeah.
It's like shuffling a deck of cards.
So instead of changing the letters themselves, you're changing their order.
You got it. A simple example is the rail fence cipher. Imagine writing your message on a fence in a zigzag pattern. To decode it, you read along the rails of the fence.
Oh, I see. So the number of rails becomes like part of the key.
Exactly. It's pretty easy to do, but if you don't know how many rails were used, it can be tough to figure out. And of course, there are more complicated transposition ciphers too.
There's always another layer, isn't there? It seems like cryptography is all about making things as hard to crack as possible.
Well, yeah. You want your secrets to stay secret, right? And that brings us to another key distinction, symmetric versus asymmetric encryption.
Ooh. Okay. I've heard those terms before, but honestly, I'm a little fuzzy on what they actually mean. It sounds kind of intimidating.
I know. The names can sound complicated, but they're not too bad once you get the hang of it. The difference is all about the keys. With symmetric encryption, you use the same key to both encrypt and decrypt the message. It's like having a shared secret.
Okay, so far so good. But it can't be that easy, right? There's got to be a downside.
Well, the tricky part is how do you get that shared key to the other person securely? You need a safe way to share the key, which can be tough if you're not in the same place.
Because if someone gets their hands on the key, it's game over.
Exactly. And that is where asymmetric encryption comes in. This is also called public key cryptography.
Okay, this is the one that always kind of blows my mind. Two keys. How does that even work?
Yeah, it's pretty ingenious. So instead of one key, you have two. You have a public key, which, like the name suggests, you can share with anyone. And then you have a private key, which you keep secret, just yourself.
So the public key is like your address, and anyone can use it to send you mail. But your private key is like the key to your mailbox. Only you can open it and read what's inside.
Perfect analogy. And the really cool thing is that anyone can use your public key to encrypt a message. But only you, with your private key, can decrypt it.
Okay, yeah, that solves the whole key sharing problem, doesn't it?
It does. But of course, there are always trade-offs. Asymmetric encryption, while very secure, it's also slower than symmetric encryption, especially when you're dealing with a lot of data.
So symmetric is faster, but asymmetric is more secure when it comes to sharing keys. Sounds like they each have their pros and cons. Is there a way to combine them, like get the best of both worlds?
You're thinking like a cryptographer. That's where hybrid cryptography comes in.
Hybrid cryptography. Two is better than one, right? So how does that work?
All right. So let's say you want to send a really important document, something super secret. With hybrid cryptography, you're essentially using two layers of protection, kind of like a safe within a safe.
Ooh, I like where this is going. Lay it on me.
So first, you use a symmetric key to encrypt the document itself. This is like putting it in a briefcase and locking it up tight. It's fast, it's efficient, but you still need to get that key to the recipient, right?
Right. Otherwise, they can't open the briefcase. So how do we get around that key sharing problem?
That's where the asymmetric key comes in. You take that symmetric key, the one for the briefcase, and you encrypt it using the recipient's public key. It's like putting that locked briefcase inside a bigger, even more secure safe.
Okay, so you have the encrypted document, the briefcase, and then you have the encrypted key to the briefcase inside another safe.
Got it. So how does the recipient get through all those layers?
They use their private key, the one only they have, to unlock that outer safe, revealing the symmetric key inside. Then they use that symmetric key to unlock the briefcase, revealing the original document. Wow, that's impressive. Like a super secure multi-step delivery system. It combines the speed of symmetric encryption with the secure key exchange of asymmetric encryption. Brilliant. Are there any specific algorithms that are like the stars of the show in these categories?
Oh, absolutely. For symmetric encryption, you've got algorithms like DES and 3DES, which were the big players for a while.
DES, that rings a bell. Wasn't that supposed to be like unbreakable at some point?
Well, they thought so at the time. DES stands for Data Encryption Standard. It was widely used, but yeah, it's not quite as secure as it used to be. Think of it like trying to secure your house with, I don't know, a really simple lock.
Not super reassuring. So that's where 3DES came in, to beef things up a bit.
Exactly. 3DES is basically applying the DES algorithm three times. Makes it a lot tougher to crack. But even with that improvement, it's still not as fast or as efficient as some of the newer algorithms. And that's where AES comes in. Advanced Encryption Standard.
AES. I knew I'd heard that before. So what makes AES so special?
It's got a much longer key length than DES, which makes it way more secure. Going back to that house analogy, it's like having a super high-tech security system with multiple layers of protection. Plus, AES is faster, especially when you're working with large amounts of data.
So AES is like the gold standard for symmetric encryption these days.
You could say that. It's used everywhere. Websites, data encryption on your phone, you name it. Now, on the asymmetric side, the rock star is definitely RSA.
RSA, okay. That one definitely rings a bell. Isn't that like the backbone of online security?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. It's named after its creators, Revest, Shamir, and Adelman. Really smart guys. RSA is what secures a lot of our online world. Websites, online transactions, email, VPNs, you name it.
It's everywhere. Okay, so what's the magic behind RSA? What makes it so effective?
It all comes down to this really cool mathematical concept. Prime factorization. You know how you can multiply two prime numbers together?
Yeah, like 7 times 11 is 77.
Right. Easy peasy. But what if I gave you a really, really big number and asked you to figure out which two prime numbers were multiplied to get that number?
Oh, gosh, that sounds like a nightmare. I'd need a supercomputer and a whole lot of time.
Exactly. Mm. And that's essentially what makes RSA so secure. Factoring a really large number into its prime factors, it's computationally very, very difficult, even for the most powerful computers.
So it's like the math itself is the security. That's wild. Okay, so RSA keeps our communications safe, but you also mentioned this thing called public key infrastructure, or PKI. What exactly is that?
Okay, imagine a world without driver's licenses or passports.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know if someone is who they say they are?
Chaos. Total chaos.
Right. PKI is like the digital equivalent of that. It uses something called digital certificates to verify the identities of websites and individuals online.
Okay, so it's like a digital passport for the internet.
Exactly. And these certificates, they're issued by these trusted organizations called certificate authorities, or CAs.
So when I go to a website and I see that little padlock icon in the address bar, that's PKI doing its thing.
Exactly. It means your browser has checked the website certificate, made sure it's valid, and confirmed that you're actually connected to the real website, not some fake version.
That's good to know. Makes me feel a little safer already. So we've got these powerful algorithms, this whole system for verifying identities online. It's pretty amazing how it all works together, but this is obviously a constantly evolving field, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got things like elliptic curve cryptography, or ECC, which is gaining popularity because it's even more efficient. And then there's quantum computing, which has the potential to completely change the game.
Quantum computing, yeah. I feel like that's the next big thing, but I'll be honest, I'm not entirely sure what it is or how it works.
It's pretty mind-blowing stuff. Traditional computers, they use bits, which can be either a 0 or a 1. But quantum computers, they use qubits, which can be a 0, a 1, or both at the same time.
Wait, both at the same time? How is that even possible?
It's quantum mechanics. It's a completely different way of looking at information and computation. But the thing is, this quantum computing power, it could be used to break a lot of the encryption we use today.
Oh no, that doesn't sound good. So, is our current cryptography doomed?
Not necessarily. Cryptographers are already working on new algorithms that are resistant to quantum attacks. It's an ongoing challenge, but one that pushes the boundaries of what's possible.
A good reminder that the world of cryptography never stands still. There's always something new to learn, some new challenge to tackle. Well, I have to say, this deep dive has been eye-opening. From ancient ciphers to the mind-bending world of quantum computing, we've covered a lot of ground.
It's been a fascinating journey.
It really makes you appreciate the important role cryptography plays in our lives. It's the silent force that keeps our data safe, our communications secure, and allows us to navigate the digital world with, well, maybe a little more confidence.
I'd say so.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us on this incredible journey into the world of cryptography. Until next time, stay curious and stay safe.